This is the first day of this January 7-day Rohatsu Sesshin of 2012. And it's a privilege to have gathered together with everyone for this Sesshin in honor of the Buddha's enlightenment. For the first few days, we're going to be reading from the teachings of the Japanese Zen master Bankei. Who knew a few things about enlightenment himself. Bankei, by the way, most of our texts that we read from in Sesshin are the Chinese masters. This Bankei is an outstanding Japanese master, born in 1622. Just to offer a little east-west equivalencies, during Bankei's life, the Plymouth colony was established here on the east coast. The Dutch colony of New Amsterdam, now known as New York City, was founded. Boston and Harvard were founded. Vesuvius erupted. The first coffee shop opened in London. And we began the extermination of American Indians, and there was the extermination of Christianity in Japan. The Dalai Lama's Potala was being built during Bankei's life. It was, of course, a much earlier Dalai Lama, still called the Dalai Lama. In Berlin, it was the beginning of Unter den Linden, and this was the age of Descartes, Galileo, Hobbes, Newton, Rembrandt, Spinoza, John Locke, Johann Kepler, Francis Bacon, Pascal. Never the twain shall meet, but the twain did meet in time, Asia and the West. So he was born in 1622. He was the youngest of three sons to his father and parents. This was parents. His father died when he was 10. No, excuse me. His father died when his older brother was 10. I'm reading from a book called Bankei Zen, Translations from the Record of Bankei, and this is by Peter Haskell, translated by Peter Haskell. So when Bankei's father died, Bankei's older brother, Tadayasu, became head of the household. And we're told that Bankei and his older brother were like water and oil. Like his father, Tadayasu seems to have been a Confucian, a stern moralist with a conviction of the importance of serious study and obedience. By contrast, the young Bankei tended to be wild, unruly, and defiant, a ringleader in any mischief, and the village champion at rock fighting. I'm going to be switching back and forth some. The other book about Bankei is The Unborn, The Life and Teaching of Zen Master Bankei. And this one was translated by Norman Waddell. Every year, on the occasion of the boys' festival, the village youths took part in stone-throwing contests, dividing into sides and hurling small stones at one another from opposite sides of a nearby river. You wouldn't see that happen very often these days. This annual event had been held in the district for over 500 years in order to inculcate warrior virtues in the young boys. We're told that whichever side Bankei was on invariably won because he would never retreat no matter how hard the stones rained down on him. When Bankei was 11, less than a year after his father's death, he was sent to a village school where he took an immediate interest in his studies. But the calligraphy lessons were a different matter. He hated those. To avoid the tedious monotony of copying and recopying Chinese characters from the teacher's copy book, he made a practice of always returning home well before the class was over. His older brother repeatedly took him to task for this, but it didn't seem to work. When he returned home, Bankei had to cross a river. His brother instructed the ferryman not to allow him to board if he should come along early. Bankei was not easily to be denied. "The ground must continue under the water," he declared, and he strode right into the stream, struggling along over the bottom until he emerged breathless at the far bank. Finally, he had had enough of his brother, and he decided he would commit suicide. Bankei decided he would commit suicide. He had heard that eating poisonous spiders was fatal, so he swallowed a mouthful of them and shut himself up inside a small Buddhist shrine to await the end. Many hours later, seeing that he was still alive, he abandoned the attempt and went home. So we get a sense of the character of this man. And then things came to a head again when Bankei had to memorize this great Confucian classic called Great Learning. And Bankei, in his own autobiographical account, he said his curiosity was aroused by the opening words of the text. And these are the words from this Confucian classic: "The way of great learning lies in illuminating bright virtue." The whole sentence, that's just the beginning of the first sentence, the whole sentence reads, "The way of great learning lies in illuminating bright virtue, in loving the people and abiding in the highest good." Well, this reference to bright virtue really, provoked great questioning in Bankei. The translator Peter Haskell tells us that bright virtue is one of the key concepts of great learning. It was often interpreted as a kind of dynamic, intuitive moral sense that constitutes man's intrinsic nature. An even broader definition of virtue is basic clarity. From a Zen perspective, we could say it's the basic clarity of the mind. Or we could say it's another word for true nature. Bankei when he asked what this bright virtue was, no one actually seemed to know what it was, and Bankei was left to puzzle out the problem for himself. He became very deeply disappointed and consumed by questioning, and he began to avoid classes. His older brother was outraged at his refusal to go to school, and it says, life at home became increasingly unpleasant. Bankei now would not go back to school, and he reportedly concealed himself in the graveyard of the family temple. Oh, that's when he attempted to commit suicide by swallowing spiders. Finally, his older brother, Tadayasu, booted him out of the household. He was just 13 now, and still in quest of what the meaning of bright virtue was, he began to study with the local priest, Buddhist priest. And finally, someone constructed a small retreat for him on the on a mountainside. He was only, say, 14 now, 14 or 15. Yeah, Bankei practiced alone there for a while, but then he went off in search of a teacher to help him, because he was getting nowhere. Actually, he's probably getting somewhere, but he didn't know it at the time. He tried studying esoteric Buddhism. It's different school of Buddhism and Zen. And then his search brought him to the Japanese Zen master Umpo. Now he was 16. Says the questions he seems to have, these questions he seems to have lumped collectively under the rubric of bright virtue. But he decided that only Buddhism effectively confronted the sort of problems that concerned him. And of all the Buddhist sects he had tried, Zen seemed the most promising. So he now this Umpo, who he found, the teacher, we're told that that few were bold-hearted enough to enter his chambers, and they usually fled before long. But Bankei, of course, charged in and told Umpo that he was not able to come to terms with this bright virtue. And Umpo told him if he wanted to discover what it meant, he would have to do zazen, sitting meditation. Well, Bankei right away said, all right, sign me up, and he asked to be ordained as a Buddhist monk. And then Bankei spent 3 years with Umpo. The translator here says he's probably subjected to a demanding training program, which mainly consisted of sitting. And then after those 3 years with Umpo, when he was 19, Bankei set out on an extended journey around the country. He had no fixed residence then. He stayed in temples here and there, but more often he lived a solitary life in rude, self-made huts, or frequently he merely slept in the open. He's reported to have lived among beggars for several years. And we have this recount from the original records of Bankei's his autobiography. I pressed myself without mercy, draining myself mentally and physically. At times I practiced deep in the mountains, in places completely cut off from all human contact. I fashioned primitive shelters out of paper, pulled that over me, and did zazen seated inside. Sometimes I would make a small lean-to by putting up two walls of thick paper boards and sit in solitary darkness inside doing zazen, never lying down to rest even for a moment. Whenever I heard of some teacher who I thought might be able to give me advice, I went immediately to visit him. I lived that way for several years. There were few places in the country I did not set foot. You know, it's so easy to read this kind of thing. It takes us about a minute to go through these years of Spartan self-discipline. But I can just imagine what it involved. Then Bhakti went back to Umpo after these 4 years on the road. He was 23 now, and he still felt no closer to resolving the doubt that was pressing in on him. He is said to have been weeping in discouragement as he told Umpo how he had been unable to find a single person in all his travels who could give him the kind of help he wanted. To which Umpo said, "It's you're striving to find someone that keeps you from your goal." Well, these were just the right words, apparently, because now Bhanke realized that he had to look within himself. He left Umpo again, found another hermitage, and now he isolated himself completely from contact with the outside, walling himself up within his tiny dwelling. He sat constantly, day and night, dedicating himself with even greater urgency to zazen, resolved, just as the Buddha before him had been, not to get up until he had found the way through. Eventually, his buttocks and thighs became inflamed and swollen from constant contact with the bare rock floor. Now, this is possibly the only time in my career I've ever heard of even a Zen master sitting without a cushion. As most of you must know, the cushion isn't only to be a little more comfortable in our seat, but to give us, when we're sitting up on a cushion and our knees are lower than our hips, then we have this pelvic tilt that makes it easier to hold the back straight. But apparently, Bhanke was using no cushion. And his buttocks and thighs began to fester. He kept sitting. He gave up eating for weeks at a time. He threw cold water over himself whenever he felt even the slightest approach of the demons of sleep. That's what they would call it in the monasteries. And here's a description of this time in his life where he was secluded. The room, about 10 feet square, resembled nothing so much as a prison cell. There was only one small opening, just large enough for an arm to pass through. He plastered the door shut with mud so that no one could enter to bother him. Food was passed to him through the hole in the wall twice each day. After he had finished eating it, he placed the bowl outside the opening once again. A privy was arranged just below the wall so that he could relieve himself from inside the room through a small aperture made for that purpose. You know, this sounds to our ears so bizarre and fanatical. It's I think it's more widely known. At least I've read more of this kind of extreme seclusion in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. Less of it in Zen. And it certainly is hard for anyone who hasn't felt this kind of desperation to awaken to their true nature. It's hard to wrap your mind around what could have driven him into this, what to most people would seem to be almost madness. Finally, these years of struggle left him with tuberculosis. My condition, back to his own words, my condition steadily worsened. I grew weaker and weaker by the day. Whenever I spat, blood would appear on the wall. Once I spat against a wall and the globules stuck and slid to the ground in bright red beads. The illness reached a critical stage. For a whole week, I was unable to swallow anything except some thin rice broth. The physician who examined him is reported to have thrown aside his medicine spoon. Bankei was past the point where such remedies could be of help. He was now resigned to dying. And just then, everything turned around. These are his own words. I felt a strange sensation in my throat. I spat against a wall. A mass of black phlegm, large as a soap berry, rolled down the side. Suddenly, just at that instant, I realized what it was that had escaped me until now. All things are perfectly resolved in the unborn. After 14 years of incredible hardship, he had achieved a decisive enlightenment, his doubts and uncertainties disappearing like a dream. Immediately he felt his strength begin to return. His appetite improved almost miraculously, and with it, his health. All things are perfectly resolved in the unborn. Let's look at this unborn, this word unborn, because it's not a common word in Zen texts, although it does appear, it appeared before Bankei's day. Maybe if you have trouble relating to this word, the unborn, which I used to, think of it as that which is beyond time. Think of it as the eternal. All things are perfectly resolved in the eternal. It is, all things are resolved in this, the realm of the unconditioned, beyond all change, beyond coming and going, before and after, beyond past and future and even present, beyond time, beyond space, beyond discrimination, differentiation. To turn this around a little differently, that our suffering arises from this discriminating mind and its attachment to thoughts. And the principal thought, of course, is the illusion of self, self and other, this notion of separation, that I'm here and the rest of the world is out there. This notion that We follow this reality as just a linear chronology of birth, aging, decay, death. It's not that there's no validity to that. Of course, we know that in a conventional sense, this is how things work. We age. We're born, we age, we die. But that's only half the truth. The other side, the dark side of the moon, is what is beyond all such distinctions, beyond time and space. And in that realm, there are no fundamental problems. We read that soon after this experience, this great enlightenment, another enlightenment occurred. And this was while he was washing his face in a stream, and a morning breeze brought to him the fragrance of plum blossoms. At that instant, the record says, all attachments and obstacles were swept from his mind once and for all. The doubts that had been plaguing him ceased to exist. So we hear, we see this in the lives of other great masters, that as significant as his first awakening was, it was followed by one even deeper still. That enlightenment is not a black and white thing. It's not all or nothing. That a first awakening experience is usually quite faint. It's a small experience, smaller than Bankei's first experience. But then one can have subsequent awakenings, some of them deeper than one's first one. The takeaway from this, don't ever be satisfied, whatever experience you have. Don't settle for whatever it was. When he was strong enough to travel, he made his way back to Umpo. Umpo was overjoyed. He said, "This is the marrow of Bodhidharma's bones. From now on, no one anywhere will be able to touch you." But he said, "Go get verification from other masters." And he recommended one that Bankei then went to. He was now 26. Bankei was 26. And he was on his way. And then he got word of the arrival in Japan of a Chinese master by the name of Dao Che. And Umpo urged him to go pay Dao Che a visit. Now, Dao Che spoke no Japanese, and Bankei spoke no Chinese. So they had to communicate through written characters. This is the remarkable thing about this transition where Zen went from China to Japan, that you had great monks like Bankei Chinese masters would have to communicate through the written language, the characters, the ideographs, because neither spoke or understood the other's language. So Bankei decided to join the assembly, the monks' assembly of this Chinese master Dao Zhi, and he experienced another enlightenment while sitting in a darkened corner of the meditation hall. File that one away, folks. While sitting in a darkened corner of the meditation hall. He took his realization to the master, and Dao Zhi said, "What about the matter of birth and death?" He wrote that. He had to have written it. Bankei said that to the master. "What about the matter of birth and death?" And in reply, Dao Zhi wrote, "Whose birth and death is this?" Bankei extended both hands. Dao Zhi took up his brush again, but this time Bankei snatched it away and hurled it to the floor. The following day, Dao Zhi publicly announced that Bankei had completed his practice and he made him the head cook, which was traditionally a position reserved for the most advanced students in a Zen monastery. Bankei stayed with Dao Zhi for about a year and received a full transmission, Dharma transmission. But then it says here, nevertheless, in retrospect, he recognized Dao Zhi's limitations He was off again. Then he got word that Umpo, his first teacher, was in failing health. He returned and got there just in time to attend his teacher's funeral. That happened with me. I was in Germany, in Berlin, when I got word that Roshi would soon be passing, and I jumped on an earlier flight, changed my flight, and got on an earlier one, but didn't get back in time. He had already died. I'm going to skip through some of this. It's just too much detail to spend any more than the first teisho on this. So now Bankei was to become a Zen master in his own right. It says, still something of the enfant terrible. He reportedly elicited objections from traditionalists for refusing to observe the conventions of the ceremony, the Dharma transmission ceremony. But it wouldn't have bothered him. As his fame spread, he acquired numerous followers among the upper ranks of the samurai. They vied for his visits and offered temples in their domains, in the capitals of Kyoto and Edo. Edo was the previous name for Tokyo, or the previous capital of Japan. The following years found Bankei frequently in seclusion at one or another of the cloisters provided by his benefactors, practicing alone, instructing a select group of disciples, or nursing his recurrent illness. Bankei's early struggles had taken a severe toll on his health, and in later life he was often in extreme discomfort, afflicted with chronic stomach spasms and fits of coughing that required intervals of quiet convalescence. At the age of 57, he made a significant change in his approach to practice, and he shifted to practicing with others at large assemblies of monks and giving public talks, Dharma talks. From this time until his death, Bankei continued to conduct important training periods nearly every year, traveling to his various temples and sometimes delivering as many as 3 talks a day. Now, this is what is very distinctive about Bankei. He would not tolerate repressive behavior such as the beating or scolding that still characterizes training at many Zen temples. This is one of the regrettable things about many temples still in Japan, is the kind of hazing and abusive treatment. And he wouldn't allow the traditional begging or the takahatsu, the going through the rounds of the villages and towns to receive food and other donations. But Bankei's training included the usual backbone of formal sitting and chanting and doksan. And he also continued to do funeral and memorial services for those who scrupulously upheld the Buddhist precepts. No, excuse me, that's Bankei. He continued to scrupulously uphold the Buddhist precepts in his personal life. Bankei's later years were marked by constant travel between his various temples and patrons. When he was 58, he suffered a severe loss with the death of his mother, who had become a Buddhist nun and retired to a convent. She had retired to a convent. Bankei had always been fiercely devoted to his mother and insisted that what had originally driven him to realize enlightenment had been, above all, his desire to communicate the truth to her. There it is, another kind of toss-away sentence, and we can just wonder about the backstory there, the real depth of feeling and deep attachment he had to his mother. When he was 58, he conducted the most famous of his training periods, a vast 3-month period attended by nearly 1,700 monks of every sect of Buddhism. The space in the zendo was quickly exhausted, and a temporary zendo had to be improvised to accommodate the flood of new arrivals. Okay, we were spared that this week. Says that this training period was funded by the Sasaki brothers, and the crowd of monks grew so immense that the Sasakis panicked and vainly begged Bankei to turn away any further applicants. So he didn't do it. It's hard to turn people down for Sasshin, sincere people, even knowing that it's going to be crowded. It's going to be more difficult to manage the Sasshin, certainly more demanding on the teacher. It's hard to turn people down, especially when you want everyone in the world to go to Sasshin. He gave 60 lectures, Dharma talks, at this huge congregation, and that's what constitute these teachings, these talks that we'll be reading from, this book that we'll be reading from for the rest of the next few days. Excuse me, he was 68 when he gave this huge training period. And now at the age of 71, his health had worsened and he realized he had little time left. His condition continued to worsen and he died. He was given, he was awarded the posthumous title, imperial title of Kokushi, which means national master. Well, all right, that brings us to the end of our time today. We'll stop now and recite the four Bodhisattva vows.